This is Build and Analyze, a weekly news and discussion show about the world of iPhone, iPad, iOS, mobile web development, and more. The show is hosted by Marco Arment. He is the creator of Instapaper.com. And by me, I'm Dan Benjamin. We would like to say thanks very much to our two sponsors today, FreshBooks.com and Shopify.com. I'll tell you more about them as the show goes on. We also want to mention that bandwidth for episode number 33, this episode right here, has been provided by Midas Green Technologies, virtual private servers submerged in oil. Seriously, check them out at MidasGreenTech.com. So we thought this might be a bigger week because we were all, everybody collectively hoping that we'd be seeing Lion. But it has not reared its head. So we have other things to talk about, though.
Right.
Not just Lion. I mean, we're going to talk more on this show than just Lion forever.
Right. Well, honestly, I'm actually recording this online right now, but I don't even know if I'm allowed to tell you that. Oh, my God. There's not that much to say about it yet, as far as I know. I mean, I've only used it casually on my laptop for, you know, a total of maybe an hour of usage, because I don't use my laptop much, as we talked about last week. And, in day-to-day usage today, I don't think it's a massive difference. But what's going to be the big deal with Lion is, as app developers start taking advantage of its really cool stuff like versions and the auto save and like the quit and resume, all that stuff, that's actually really, really nice stuff. Like, one of the very first things I had to do with Lion, I had to install something that required a reboot, I forget what, and I had a text edit document open, and text edit just closed. It was unsaved. And it just closed.
Right.
And then the computer rebooted, and then it booted back up again, and TextEdit launched, and there it was.
Just right there.
A document. Yeah. Just.
You didn't have to relaunch the app. It just started on its own.
Yeah. It's great. Like, oh man, I hope TextMate actually gets an update.
No,
even if it's a little one.
It's not
just
gonna.
Even if it just adds that. Because I always have like 10 untitled, unsaved TextMate documents open with little snippets of stuff in it. And I would love just that one ability. Just let TextMate be able to crash or quit and resume with all my little untitled documents everywhere. But honestly, I'm not holding my breath for TextMate. I'm really on the verge of going to BBEdit, just because I really, even though I don't know anything about BBEdit, but what I do know about it is that people who use it are still using it. And that's a really good sign, because like, it seems like Bare Bones is really on top of things, and they really want... they're committed to their product enough to keep updating it, whereas I really can't say the same thing about Alan Odgaard for TextMate. It's a shame, because I love the program, but it just seems like it's abandoned.
I mean, we could probably spend the whole hour talking about that. TextMate has such a huge following of people who really, really, really like it for so many different reasons, and it really has been abandoned. I mean, the same could be said for BBEdit, by the way, and I love both text editors a whole lot. TextEdit it has pretty much all, everybody who develops in Rails for the most part is probably using TextEdit.
BBEdit, you mean?
No, TextEdit.
TextEdit?
Yeah.
What?
What am I calling it? TextMate.
The built-in program? Oh, yeah, okay. Let's redo
that whole segment.
Right.
TextMate.
It's usually unlike you to make how many
times did I call
it's
it
hot
TextEdit?
In the closet today?
It is. It's really hot in here. It really is. I was just thinking that. Like, man, it's hot. Like, I'm going to have to, you know, I'm right here with the clothes. I could just put some other clothes on. But it is. It's very hot in here. It's uncomfortable. So I just do a quick swap for when I said text edit, I meant text mate.
Right.
Text mate.
Although
when
I said text edit earlier, I did mean
you actually did mean it. And that's what I think that's what threw me off, because I started thinking about that and then the heat in this room. TextMate, I mean, there's so many great things. It's not going to get updated, though, people. It's just not. It's not. It's not a priority for the developer. But you know what? So what? He decided not to update it. He decides to update it. Whatever. The fact is, right now, if you want something different or you want something new, BBEdit is different. It is new, and it's been updated, and it's also old. It's been around since I first started using Macs, just about.
Right. And there's, you know, one important fact here. I don't know if I mentioned this last week. I have this draft blog post in my head called Software is a Service. you know, we used to hear the phrase software as a service a lot to refer to web apps or subscription pricing of desktop apps. But software is a service in that it always requires ongoing maintenance. So even if it's the kind of thing where it's sold once and that's it, in most cases where consumers are using it, you know, on personal computers that are getting OS updates and occasionally need security updates and are their needs are shifting over time, the software has to be updated with those needs. So sure, right now, you know, I bought TextMate in like 2005 or 2004, some crazy amount of time ago. And I'm still using that same license that I bought however many years ago because he hasn't given me a chance to give him more money yet. But I, like, to me, TextMate has been a service. When I think it was Snow Leopard, when Snow Leopard was released, he actually did issue an update to it because the default file opener file save dialog was defaulting to the root of the whole system, which was annoying. And there was like one other annoying key binding bug that he fixed.
Right, like switching windows with arrows instead of the brackets, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, and even like Snow Leopard did break a couple of minor annoyance things like that, and he did issue a fix pretty quickly about that. So it's not like the developer's like missing or gone. It just seems like for whatever reason, updating TextMate 1 in any significant way is no longer a priority for him. Maybe it's because he's working on 2. Maybe he's just busy with other things in his life. I have no idea. I don't know the guy, but you know, it seems like it's abandoned to me. And but not 100%, like, because 100% abandoned would mean like if it didn't work under Lion for whatever little annoying reason or possibly a big fatal reason, then it would be dead. Because then like we're all going to upgrade to Lion, and if this thing doesn't work, we're going to have to switch. I don't think there's going to be that kind of bug anytime soon. At least because right now I'm using it to view my notes right now, and it's working fine. I think, but you know, eventually there will come that time. When software that seems effectively abandoned, there will come a time where there's some OS update that we all want to upgrade to and the software won't work on it. Or in the case of Lion, maybe he never adds support for autosave and resume and versions, and we come to expect those things from our software. Then it's going to start looking old and dated a lot more quickly than we thought and maybe than he thought. And so if it's not worth updating anymore, to him, it might very quickly fall out of favor because it's missing things that we consider now to be normal things. Yeah. Or even other things like iCloud. I don't know the details of how this works for Mac apps, but one of the great things about it on iOS, which I'm probably not allowed to talk about, is that you could use iCloud to synchronize preferences of your app. So that if somebody has multiple devices or multiple computers and they have your app installed on all of them, they can sync their preferences across all of them really easily. And something like TextMate that actually has a lot of preferences and a pretty big setup with things like plugins and color schemes and all this other stuff, that would be awesome. Because what I do now is when I get a new machine, I just copy my TextMate application support folder onto the new one from the old one, and that way it imports all my settings and stuff. But that's kind of a crappy way to do it. I would love to, and then if I make a change somewhere, then I have to do it manually on all the other computers. So that's no good. Basically, software is never done. It's always an ongoing service, and it always needs maintenance. Like, I'm sure, I bet the developer didn't anticipate something like Lion's new features that we're all going to want being something that he really needed to address. And then once he saw it, I'm sure he probably at least thought about that. He seems like a really smart guy. I don't know the guy, so I don't really want to speculate on his motives, but it just seems like for whatever reason he's really busy elsewhere, and it's a shame because I do everything in TextMate, and today it works.
Or TextEdit, whichever you want to.
Right.
But that's like, the thing. No,
today,
I mean, that's,
TextMate works great, but I don't know, like...
It's gonna be different, and there are gonna be these features that we might not take them for granted in Lion in the first week, but... In the first month or two or three, you're going to have a really big divide between the apps that have been updated and the apps that haven't. Just because you'll get so used to the exact scenario that you described, which was, I rebooted, it came right back. This is exactly where I wanted it to be. that right now you think it's a feature that you maybe you will use, maybe you won't, you might get used to. In 6 months, you'll just take it for granted that that's there and that's how it works. And then you'll have this one app that you really like, but it doesn't behave.
Right. A really important app.
Right. And that'll be the compelling reason to switch.
I write code. I mean, I don't use it for Xcode editing. I use Xcode's built-in editor. But for website code, I use TextMate. For shell scripts, for any kind of text editing task that's not done in Xcode, writing blog posts even, all of it, like my little to-do list, everything is in TextMate. And I know it inside and out. I'm very, very efficient while working in it. So the learning curve of moving to a different editor, no matter how good that editor is, it's a significant learning curve. Because there's all these little key shortcuts and little behaviors that I know exactly how they work and all these little things that are going to be different. And but at this point, like if somebody asked me today what text editor they would use, I would never tell them to use TextMate because I'm just afraid that it's you know, in its last days.
Why not switch to BBEdit?
The learning curve. That's really it.
That's the only reason.
At this point in the back of my head, switching BBEdit is the kind of thing that I have planned for someday, which probably means only when I'm forced to do it because it's such a big learning curve. Although it might not be. Honestly, I've never even tried it. I could be overestimating the learning curve here, which would be embarrassing. So I'm sorry to bare bones if I am.
It's an investment for the future, right?
Right. But it's just I have the momentum now with TextMate. I know exactly how it works. It is a deeply ingrained part of my workflow, and so it's going to take a huge motivator to switch away from it. Which that motivator would probably be it stops working in an OS update. But I'll see. I mean, what would really suck is if I stop using it, and then like the next month, Alan releases TextMate 2. But honestly, I'm really giving up hope here. I really don't think it's going to happen. Oh man, I can't. Oh, that's annoying.
What happened?
I can't collapse the toolbar in Colloquy. I don't know how to pronounce that.
I think that's right.
Because the toolbar collapsing jelly bean thing is no longer present in Lion.
Really? Is this breaking NDA right here?
No, I think I've heard someone else say that. I think I heard John Siracusa say that.
So here's
someone else told me that, so that's not breaking NDA because I didn't, I don't know.
Here's a question, and I'll ask you this because, you know, the jury is still out. John Siracusa and I talked about this a little bit on Hypercritical earlier today. But my question for you is, said at the top of the show, there's no Lion yet. Why? Why is there no Lion? Why is there no new MacBook Airs? Why is there no new hardware? If one was waiting on the other, they both seem ready. What's the holdup?
Well, one thing they could do, keep in mind, is that they could just say, here are the new MacBook Airs ready to order online today. They ship in 2 weeks. So, you know, they don't necessarily need to hold the laptops for the OS.
Right.
If they want to release the laptops, they can. But there's also, besides the rumor mill geeks like us, there aren't a lot of people clamoring for the new MacBook Airs. So it doesn't really hurt Apple to delay them by a week or two if they need to. There's not a massive demand here for this one computer to be available right now because they're already available in the stores and they're already selling pretty well, as far as we know. So there's really not, besides the geeks like us. And by the way, I use the term geeks lovingly. I hope people get that. I try, like in my blog posts and stuff, I really hope people know that I'm saying geeks inclusively with me.
Right.
I am a geek.
I think they
and
get
I
that.
Love the term. Like I think, and of course we can argue about the definitions of geek, nerd, dweeb, dork, all those other words. I think I actually don't know the difference between geek and nerd. Please don't tell me. But I please don't email me. But to me, a geek is somebody who cares more than the average people expect them to care about something, or more than average people care about that thing. And I love that because I'm a geek with a lot of things. And if that's the definition, I care about a lot of things more than most people do. And I love that definition. And I think it's a wonderful thing to care. There's all that stuff. With Lion, who knows? The email they sent to developers a few days ago that said submit your apps today for Lion to the store because it's coming out this month, I think that to me said it's not coming out this week because usually in the iOS world, they send out those emails about 2 weeks before it comes out. So because, I mean, app review times are such that, you know, 2 weeks is a pretty good estimate of, you submit 2 weeks ahead of time and you'll probably be there in time for the release. If you get rejected, you almost definitely won't make it. But if you're approved, you'll probably make it for the release. So if they're following that same pattern, I'd say Line will be out in a week and a half. So maybe you know, the Tuesday after next. Who knows?
Hmm.
But that's imprecise. I mean, they could do whatever they want. It's the App Store. And that actually helps them a lot, too. There is no retail disc stamping going on here. They can pretty much do it whenever they want. And so they can do it when it's ready. You know, rather than having a 0.0 that has some really weird bugs, they can wait a few more days and fix a few more really tiny things. Or maybe they're just trying to coordinate marketing with something. You know, maybe the laptops are delayed and they were holding off Lion for the laptops. That's possible too.
Sure.
So it doesn't really matter. It's the middle of July. Nothing's happening. You know, like it's the summertime is a very slow news cycle. It's, you know, a lot of people are on vacation. It isn't a good time to launch something incredibly important. And that might also, that help that that effect alone might be the reason why they're kind of pushing the iPhone release it to September. We'll see. But even, you know, the biggest reason to launch new laptops in the summertime would be back to school sales. But even that, you tend to do earlier in the summer, like June, because like a lot of people get computers for graduation, like if you graduate from high school, you might get a computer to go to college with. So even that, I think we're missing the timing on that. So all this boils down to, they really have no reason to release it this week. If, you know, if they can't, or if it's inconvenient, they can wait till next week or the week after that.
In other words, it doesn't really matter. This week, next week, whenever.
Right. I mean, everyone who is dying to use Lion probably already is using Lion. So even that doesn't matter that much. And really, again, like I mean, I put it on my laptop, but I am not even considering putting it on my desktop yet, just because I don't need to, and it's a risk to install it now. It's still officially pre-release, and I don't even know if you can easily update from the pre-release GM build to the retail build. Like, I might have to do a clean reinstall. I have no idea. So I'm not touching my work machine with this yet. But yeah, we'll see. We have some FU this week.
Oh, cool. What is it?
Mostly about last week's, actually it's entirely about last week's show. So first, about Google's compiled code with Google Plus. Please stop emailing me telling me what it is. Most people have said it's Google Web Toolkit. A few people have said it's definitely not Google Web Toolkit because it does some things differently. And it probably, regardless of what it is, involves the Clojure compiler. Thank you. Please stop telling me. Oh my God, there's been like 50 responses. Yeah, so thanks for that. And the fact is, it doesn't really matter what they're using to compile their pages. It just matters that they're using something, and that the page that is shown to us doesn't have meaningfully structured or meaningfully named markup. And at the end of the show, I want to do follow up about the MacBooks, because we got a lot of feedback about that, about the 11-inch Air and the 13-inch MacBook Pro, and people who love both of those machines, which I kind of dissed in last week's show. So I'll address that at the end when we're bored.
Our first sponsor today is FreshBooks.com, whom we would like to thank very much for making this show possible. If you're on your own business and you rely on invoicing to get paid, then you need to check out FreshBooks. These guys, they let you focus on your actual work, not things like paperwork. And they provide you with the fastest way to track time, organize expenses, and invoice your clients. It's that simple. You know, when you think of accounting, is it these sort of unorganized spreadsheets and a shoebox of receipts or a bloated accounting package that does a billion things you don't need it to do? You know, this is the thing. If you're a professional, if you're running a business, invoicing is 90% of your accounting, and FreshBooks just simplifies everything. They make it easier. You got to check these guys out. I use them, and I think you will too once you try them out. It's free to get started. You just go to freshbooks.com. You sign up for the account. And here's a really cool thing they're doing for 5x5 listeners. They're actually going to give away a birthday cake, again, every week to somebody who signs up from this show. All you need to do for a chance to win the cake is when you're signing up for free, there's a box that says, how did you hear about us? You just type build and analyze in there, and you can win a cake. And these cakes apparently are fantastic. So go check this this offer out at FreshBooks.com. We appreciate it.
What else is going on this week? There's been a lot of...
Yeah, I mean, there's different things. Not so much on the like new kind of tech geeky stuff, but there have been a whole bunch of... And a lot of people are still really talking about Google Plus. And you finally used it. You're finally there, right?
Yes. So I got in. You know, I said in my first blog post, and I said here last week, that I would join it like in an organic way, like when I was socially forced or encouraged to join it. So I wouldn't just join it because it's new and cool. I wanted to join it the way most people join social networks, which is when they are socially motivated to do so. And it turns out, if you're a geek, that's already happened for Google Plus. So I overestimated how long that would take by a lot. So turns out, if you're like in the Matt Geekosphere on Twitter, you have probably already been socially motivated to join Google Plus. And so I did. So I joined it during one of their little 5-minute things that let people in. I happened to hit one of those. And so now I can officially say I've used it. And I don't really know how to use it now. One thing is that the interface is actually pretty confusing to me. It not in the sense of like, how do I hit save? Like the controls, I think, are okay. What's confusing to me is I'm not really sure what I'm supposed to be doing. And the notifications, I think, are very confusing as well. And the way it tells me about all these different things that are happening outside of my little zone. And then when you click on it and like what you see, and like I'll try to find a permalink to somebody's post so I can open up just that, and I can't find that, or like little things like that. I'm having a lot of trouble with the interface, with finding things, but also I don't really know what I'm supposed to post there. This is obviously just really a geek problem. I bet if you use only that, you'd be fine. You'd use it the same way I use Twitter, my blog, and possibly even Facebook. I'm a terrible Facebook user. I use it barely and rarely, but even Facebook, I don't even know what to put on Facebook because my family is pretty small. We tend to just, you know, talk on the phone, or right, I'll look at their stuff on Facebook, but I don't really have anything to show them. Like even like dog pictures. Well, Tiff will post those to Facebook, so I don't need to.
Right.
And when we have kids, I'm sure it's going to be similar in that, you know, she's going to probably be the Facebook agent of the family, and so I don't need to do that. And like anything that I find significant, I put on my blog. And Twitter, I think, is a different beast, because Twitter for some people is a genuine publishing platform. Like I would say, even like the way Merlin uses it, the way Adam Lissagor uses it,
yeah,
Only Sandwich, and especially like the way Michael Lopp uses it, like it's very much a publishing platform. For me, it's more of a chat network. Like it's more of a communication tool. And so I don't really think that what I put on Twitter, that I really need to own that. And so I made this big blog post a couple days ago about, like, you know, you need to own your identity. And people have rightly said, well, why do you use Twitter? This is why. Because Twitter, to me, is a communication network. It is not a place where I'm putting a lot of standalone original thoughts that I really think matter that much, or that I think need to be preserved or that need to be archived. Even though there are lots of great tools to archive Twitter, like Matt and Reese's tweet library,
right?
I find that I don't really put things on Twitter that I want to archive very much because I just use my blog for that. That's why I'm kind of fine giving Twitter control over that part of my online life, because it's not that I don't respect it, but I don't find it significant enough to warrant archival the way I use it. But anyway, what are we talking about?
Google Plus.
Right.
Other so things have been going on.
Have you gotten into it yet?
Into the Google Plus?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm using it, but I'll tell you what my concern and my problem is here. So I wanted to use it. I wanted to essentially get set up. Unlike every other service out there, that which some people would probably say this is a bad thing, right? Is people would say, well, man, I got to go create a user account. You know, gosh, that stinks. I have 1,000 user accounts and different passwords everywhere. And, you know, and the OAuth is like, you know, never really delivered. And I actually would have preferred.
You mean OpenID?
OpenID. I would have actually preferred to have created a new account here just for this. And I'll tell you why. I have, you know, Google Apps accounts. I actually have a couple of Gmail accounts that I don't really use very much. But the problem is if you use Google Apps, you can't use Google Plus right now. Maybe they say that's coming, but, you know, whatever that value is of that statement. They said the same thing for Wave and other things. And it never materialized. Right. So saying well,
it always seems like Google's paid apps for business has been a massively low priority for them.
And very
they
much.
Always kind of get shafted with new features and even with performance a lot of times.
It takes way longer to get the features. And eventually when they usually seem to come, but it can take forever. Like getting Labs, like you remember Labs showing up in your Gmail account, that took like an extra year to get to Google Apps. So I have, you know, my HiveLogic account, which is the one that I use, that's actually connected to like a Google Apps account. And it worked. For some reason, it worked. But now they're doing some big migration with Google Apps, and they're telling me that my account can't be migrated, and I'm not sure why, but yet it works even though it's not supposed to work. All of those kinds of things. So I anticipate that within the next few days, my Google Plus account, which is connected to my HiveLogic address, is going to be gone. That's just going to stop working, and that whole profile will be gone, and I'll have to use a different one or make a new Gmail address. And things like that, the way that it again, you get back to this concept that Google has so many different moving parts and so many different departments and groups and areas and people working on different things, that it's not like there's not going to be consolidation. It's just there is never any plan for consolidation, that they're always going to be different, and that tying these things together is a futile effort. It's an impossibility. And something like that that says, well, you know, now what do I do? I have people that were following me and that I was following, and like Google Plus is already set up. Well, that's probably going to be taken away. So what do you do? Where do you go next? Do I make another account and tell all those people that I'm actually somewhere else? And what happens when they type in Dan Benjamin and find the account that's there? And, you know, it's strange. It's like there's no right answer for that. There's no explanation for why was I allowed to make a Google Plus account with that account anyway when I shouldn't have been, because they're going to take it away. You know, that kind of, it's very convoluted. It's very strange. So the answer to your question is no, I really haven't got into it because I get the sense it could go away at any time. And I really don't want to start over with it. I mean, I'm going to have to, but I agree with you. Like, you wonder, what do you put there?
I've hit like a notification wall too, which is whenever I post anything or comment on anything, which so far I've only made like 3 posts or comments or whatever they're called, pluses, percents. And whenever I do any of these things, I get an email in response to everything that happens as a result of that. And I turned off some of the emails, but I still get an email like when somebody comments on something I've written. And it's gotten to the point where I need to get rid of these emails because it's too much email. Even though I don't get that. I mean, I've only gotten like maybe 50 total notifications, but to me that's too much.
That's a lot.
And because that's 50 emails that I have to delete. And so it's to the point now where I want to turn that off. But I know if I turn it off, I will never go back and I will never see these things.
Yeah.
So
you almost kind of want it, but you want a little bit less intrusively.
Yeah. I mean, this is why, like, I don't know if a lot of people operate the way I do. Probably not, because I'm always wrong about things like assuming what will succeed and what won't. I'm always wrong about that. But to me, I really only live in one social network at a time. And maybe two. Like, I think because Twitter is not a pure social network and Tumblr is not a pure social network, I'm able to balance those two, and I balance those for a very long time. But I'm not really able to live on more than one social network. And I suspect that's true of a lot of people. Because to me, like, the value of Google Plus would only be such that I would be visiting it so often. I'd be like checking it like 4 or 5 times a day at least. Just checking out of habit, just to follow people there and to read stuff and to get information and notifications. Right now, what I'm doing most of that on is Twitter and RSS, which is not dead. And so Google Plus is really competing for my attention. It's competing with Twitter and RSS. But I've been using those for years, and I have pretty established and pretty large followings or people I'm following there. So like, I wouldn't want to publish something to Google Plus exclusively, and I also don't want to read Google Plus exclusively. So I'm not really sure why I would really ever use it regularly. But that maybe that's just me. Maybe that's just because I'm a weirdo.
So here, and here's sort of the... Generally, geeks are kind of paranoid. They're paranoid that they're not aware of whatever the current thinking is or whatever the new hotness is or whatever. And I think they're concerned that something will happen and there'll be this shift that will happen. And all of a sudden, Twitter, who's Twitter? What's Twitter? We're all on Google Plus. Why aren't you here? Oh, well, I'm coming now. Now, you know, I was user 3,518 and you're going to be like 10 million and you can never get, it's too late now. It's too late. And I think that's part of the fear with these social networks. If you don't get on in the beginning, if you're not on board early, it'll leave you behind and you'll still be over on like this old ancient relic of a service called Facebook or whatever. That, you know, whatever happens at Google supplants. I don't think that's going to happen, but I think there's that feeling. Remember, I mean, you remember after...
Well, you know why it won't happen?
Why won't
it
happen?
They don't have usernames.
Well, they don't yet.
No, really, like that's a big deal.
It
geeks
is a big
like
deal.
Usernames. And when a new service opens up, geeks want to go claim a really good username.
Right. Well, that was the whole thing. You remember when Facebook finally decided to allow names? I actually, a friend of mine, I knew... He wanted his name, of course. He wanted your name. And somebody else, you know, then the way Facebook did it, in case the listeners don't know this story, they said at midnight on, it was some random day that they picked, at midnight, you were going to go in and you could claim your name. Because up until then, you couldn't do that. And now you were going to be able to get your vanity URL and your name and everything. And it happened at like midnight. And
Right. Everybody
was like clamoring to get, you know, the cool name or in many cases, just the name, their own name. And a friend of mine, a software developer, fairly well known in the Rails community, was trying to do this. And somebody else, just to mess with him, was faster and got his name. Got that person's
awesome.
Name just to mess with them. And it once you have it, it's yours and it's locked in.
Yeah,
it's not
permanent.
Like,
you can never change it.
Yeah, like if you and I wanted to
fantastic.
You know, change our Twitter usernames or something, I could change mine to anything that was available. Of course, I'd potentially forfeit my current Twitter name by doing that because but you can do things like that. And with Facebook, it's locked down. There is no going back, and that created a lot of, you know, tension between those two people. But why, if you remember that, if you know that history, why as Google Plus, why would you not want to prevent that and just let them get the username from the beginning and not have to go through something like, oh, by the way, you can pick a profile name now. I hope you got yours. It just seems rude.
You know, it almost suggests that maybe Google isn't that good at social stuff.
Well, yeah, you could say that. But this seems like something so critical. It seems like something so important. You have to have this. How could they think that this 42-character string of letters and numbers would, like, who does that fly with? Well, and this is the whole point. It had to be intentional. They had to decide to do it that way. And I think the reason they decided to do it that way is because they want you searching.
Yes, exactly.
They don't want you using URLs. They want you searching. This is almost
Google
like
is the
to
world's
say,
address bar.
Right. They want you to type in Marco Arment and find your Google Plus account. They don't want you to even know. They don't want you to try using a URL. URLs are irrelevant. And I really think this is Google's philosophy, is that they want to make URLs just completely irrelevant. I was reading an article. I wish I had saved that link. I should have. It was basically talking about the importance of domain names. And was it Jason Fried? Somebody was being interviewed or asked about this. Maybe it was an interview with Evan Williams, the Twitter creator, I can't remember, but it's somebody who's fairly well known and knowledgeable about this kind of thing. And they were saying, you know what, today, 2011, not so much, not so important. Yeah, get a good domain name, but with Google around, do you really need it? Do you really need it? And that was sort of the question. They were saying you don't as much anymore. What do you think? I mean, you've got some good domains.
Well, because I've had them forever. I mean, it's really just market.org is the only good one, really. I mean,
Instapaper's pretty good.
Yeah, that turned out well, but that was more accidental. I dropped most of my domain names a few years ago because I was just tired of paying for all of them. I realized that domain names don't really have much use unless you're actually using them. Like buying them to use in the future, I realized was a huge waste of money. Unless it's ridiculously a good name, but most of mine weren't.
How many did you have? What was your max?
I think about 25, something in that range.
I mean, that's 250, $300 bucks a year, depending on what they are.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So it was a decent amount of money. I'm like, you know, I'm never going to use like 3/4 of these. So I think I'm down to like 8 now or something like that.
You can quit anytime you want.
Right. Well, most of the ones I own now are in use. Actually, I think all of them are. It was tempting to actually drop preview.fm because it costs like $60 a year because it's like the FM TLD is pretty expensive.
Yeah, that's pretty expensive.
It's a pretty expensive one. And, oh, you have one, yeah. So you know.
Yeah, we have the 5x5.fm just out of convenience so that it would be a separate. So if you're, until we have our iOS app done, it's especially important because you can just put that into your mobile Safari browser and it'll pop up the QuickTime player and you can just listen on the go. And so we did that. You can put it into iTunes and listen streaming that way of all the audio. So we wanted that. But then I was like, man, you know, 60, 70 bucks a year for that. I mean, for what it gives as a separate address for things like that. But if you're just holding on to it thinking maybe I'll do something with this, man, that's expensive.
Well, and
for
I actually
domain.
Have a service running on Preview FM. It's like a little iTunes searcher thing that at the time I made it, there was no Preview All button on iTunes albums. And it was only like a year and a half ago.
I see. And, I've never been to this site.
And so it's basically just a quick search. I was tired of, like, I hear about a new band or a new album that I wanted to check out, and browsing through the iTunes interface was so slow, and it was single window. You couldn't open up a bunch of tabs and compare them. And it drove me crazy. And so I made this little thing that uses the audio elements and a bunch of JavaScript. It only works in Safari and Chrome, as far as I know. And it even occasionally used to crash Safari because the audio element was relatively new at that point. And I have affiliate links on the albums to buy them in iTunes. That's how it supposedly pays for itself. And it's never made enough money. It's not even close. Mm. It doesn't even make $70 a year. It makes something like $8 a year. So it actually is a loss even to cover its own domain name. And so I've thought about shutting it down, but I still kind of like it. So I don't know. I could also just move it to a cheaper domain. So that's possible. But Preview FM is pretty good. So
I mean, what about the concept of just holding on to a domain name because you think somebody else might want it, especially with the popularity of all these .fm things that are coming out? Like, do you use those? Well, are you interested in any of those? What was it? Is it turntable.fm or what?
No, I don't really use most. Like, I really should get into online music startups. Like, I don't even use Last.fm or Pandora.
You only listen to one band. You only listen to Phish. So what's the difference?
Right.
I mean,
so,
for you,
right, exactly.
You got all the albums. What do you need any of that for?
Right. And all the shows. I've always had a pretty big music collection on my computer, and I've also never really been a huge fan of most new popular music. I discover new bands very slowly and rarely. And so most of those services, I tried a few of them for a while. Like, I tried Last.fm, Scrobbling, and all that stuff, trying to get recommendations for new bands to check out. And I ultimately, it proved to be more trouble than it was worth. But I don't know. I should get back into it. But yeah, so back to the original question, how much domains matter. I really don't know. I don't think they matter much. Like, you know, Color famously got their domain name for some ridiculous amount of money as part of their ridiculous funding for their ridiculous product.
You're not a Color fan.
I've never been motivated to install it. I don't know. I've seen screenshots and seen explanations, and I can't figure out for the life of me why I would want this thing. So anyway, oh well. So domains, they're kind of important in that if somebody tells you, oh, go check out Instapaper, like that should be something that somebody knows how to type in and spell properly by only hearing it and can remember the name. But they're probably typing it into a search box, not a URL bar. And I think as time goes on, we're going to see more browsers adopt the Chrome model of having the URL bar be a search box if what you type doesn't look like a URL.
Mm.
And so if that's the direction we're moving, which I think Google is very happy with that, because that means every time somebody intends to use the URL bar, it's a chance for Google to show some ads that people might click on. So Google loves that. It really reduces the value of domain names. What you really need then is PageRank. And that's in Google's best interest, because if you can't get it organically, you have to buy it. And so really that's obviously what Google would like everyone to be doing. I think they want the URL system to be more like the DNS system, which it's this thing that happens behind the scenes, this technical implementation detail that users need not ever see or worry about.
Our second sponsor today is Shopify.com. Thanks very much to them for making this and many of our other shows possible. Shopify is very simply the absolute best way to sell anything online. You get your own online store. You can accept credit cards. You can use your own domain. You can customize your store's design, and they host everything for you. So you can pick from over 50 free and premium themes from their theme store. Or if you know HTML and CSS, you just design one from scratch, make it look exactly like the rest of your website. You'll have your own shopping cart. You'll have your own streamlined checkout. They do everything for you again. And they've even got geeks in there to make sure that all the e-commerce site is totally secure. So you don't have to worry about that either. They've got built-in analytics. They've got tons of other things. Really, if you want to sell anything, whatever it is, anything, go to these guys, Shopify.com. Now, there's a 30-day free trial. And I said, listen, 30 days is not enough time for my listeners. They need more. And they said, what are you talking about? 30 days, it's fine. They don't need any more than that. I said, they need more. So they gave me this coupon code, 5x5. You'll get your first 3 months free. A shop in minutes, a business for life, Shopify.com.
We got a pretty good question from Greg Hooksprung again. He said, I'm close to releasing an app and I'm wondering how I should price it. It's going to have some pretty basic functionality at first, but I have plans for some fairly major improvements. I was considering releasing it for 99 cents or $1.99 and increasing the price by $1 with every major upgrade. Any thoughts on this pricing strategy or on pricing in general? What do you think?
It's always a weird question to try and give somebody else advice about pricing something, right?
Sure.
What would you say? You're pricing apps all the time. I don't have any apps out there.
No, I priced an app twice. Once when I launched it at $10, and then once a year later at $5.
Well, yeah, but you had free apps and you got rid of those.
I had one free app and I got rid of it once.
So that's pricing, right?
I guess. Your price sends a message about the quality of your app. And so even if you ignore the money that you'll make as an aggregate, just the message that you're sending is better if you charge more in general. You know, to a point, of course.
You're saying there's a big difference, or there's a different message, maybe not a big difference. There's a different message being sent if your app is 99 cents versus $3.99 or $4.99. And people, do you think there's still that sense that there really was early on in the history of the App Store where people felt that, like, apps should just, they should just be 99 cents. That's how much an app should cost. It should be 99 cents. And then there were other apps that kind of pushed the limits on that. But there's still, I mean, I know people who will say, oh, $2.99 for an app. I don't care how good it is. I'm not paying that. That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. I'm like, how much was your sandwich? You know?
Right, exactly.
You know, your sandwich and drink was, you know, $12.
Right. How much was your liter of Coke?
Right.
I really don't have any sympathy for people who complain about prices that are below $10 for finely crafted software. I mean, that's crazy. There's always going to be people complaining. And so if someone's complaining about your price, that doesn't mean it's too high necessarily. if no one's complaining about your price, it's too low. That's for sure. But you know, you have to balance the complaining to a reasonable level so that you're getting some complaints. But your sales are still if your sales are still pretty good, and you're getting some complaints, you're probably priced at about the right level. But yeah, the pricing sends a message. Like, so Dan, when you search the App Store, let's say you're on vacation somewhere where you didn't fly and where you aren't eating bread,
mm-hmm.
and so you're relatively
which
happy.
Is anywhere I would ever go, correct?
Right, exactly. Yeah, because I want this to be a realistic scenario for you.
Okay.
So let's say you're on vacation at the butcher shop down the street. Okay. And
okay.
That seems reasonable.
Yeah, I can.
You're buying stuff. You're buying stuff to put in your grill, and you suddenly need. You're really curious to know, how quickly am I walking here in this hot Austin summer sun?
Right.
So you want to go get one of those GPS apps that will tell you how quickly you're moving with maybe a compass or something like that built in for extra features. But you want to get something like that. So you go to the App Store and you search for whatever term I'm missing that's going to describe those things for you. So you're presented with, 10, 15 apps that all do the same thing. And, five of them are free, and they have this little yellow free thing on the banner,
mm-hmm.
on the icon. And so, you have those to choose from, and then you have, the Garmin $50 or $100 massive high-priced app on the side that's
right.
from some big brand that you probably think, I probably don't need that for this little task. And then in the middle, you have like a few apps, and like one of them is 99 cents, or a few of them are 99 cents, and they kind of look like they're made by, some weirdo 100 app company that makes all these apps poorly. And then you have like a few others that are like between $2 and $5. So how do you pick when you're presented with that? Because this is how buyers search the App Store. This
right.
is what they generally see. And this is the choice they have to make. So how do you make that choice?
Well, I'm not sure that I would do this in real life, but I think the pattern is typically, well, that one is that $50 or $99 one, that thing's just way too, that's not for me. That's for a pro. I'm not going to even look at that. Then you look at the free ones and you say, well, it seems like there's a bunch of ones you actually have to pay for. So I might even try the free ones. Might see if they do. And you know what? If they do enough, then I'm done. But I'm very skeptical because you always get ads with those. So then
I would move into
the $2 to $5 ones, and I would read reviews.
Okay, that's interesting.
That's how I do
it. So like you open up each one,
yeah.
and you'd scroll down and you kind of see
yep.
what people are doing.
That's what I've done for every single app I've ever bought. That pattern right there.
Let's say you buy one and it ends up it's not that good. Do you just deal with it or do you go back and buy a different one?
Oh, if I buy something and it turns out it just stinks, it's the worst, I'll have to go back and buy another one.
Okay. See, I think what you're describing, the pattern that you've just walked through.
I don't know
through,
if that's atypical.
No, I think it's typical. I really think this is how most people browse the App Store. First of all, you are giving more credit than most people do to reviews. Everything that I've seen and learned and read so far suggests that very few people judge an app by anything other than its icon and title.
I can imagine, I almost always disregard, I don't want to say I disregard them, but if it's a 1-star or a 5-star, I take it with a grain of salt because I've found very few 5-star. Now, unlike a podcast, like for example, if you wanted to rate this podcast 5 stars, then I would trust it. I would absolutely trust that review.
That's the only valid review.
Right. Anything else is an invalid review.
Right.
But with an app, if it's a 1-star review, that almost means people didn't understand what they were buying. It almost always means that, like they're reviewing it,
or it didn't work,
or it just didn't work. And that's important to note too. Like if you see like a whole string of 1-star reviews and they're all really recent, then maybe there's a problem with the app, and that's a good indication. But a lot of the time, the 1-star reviews are like, I bought this for my dog, and it turns out it was only for cats. I can throw that review out. The 5-star reviews, I like to pay attention to them. But if it's like 5 stars and the review itself is 5 stars, like the words 5 stars exclamation point, I don't take that in consideration. But if they actually tell us why it's 5 stars or why it's 1-star and there's like a legitimate reason and an actual explanation, then I will. But you almost want to not pay too much attention to those. It's the ones in the middle. It's the like 2, 3, and 4-star ones. Those, there's a lot of insight there. Again, in a podcast, it's unnecessary to give a podcast, at least that I would be involved with, anything less than a 5-star.
Right. Well, it's free. You can try it out and see for yourself.
Right. My advice, if you're considering rating this show, would be to either rate it 5 stars or just don't bother actually to rate it.
Right, because that sends a message to not rate it.
Right.
Yeah. So
why? What? You think people don't even read the reviews? They just look at the name of the app and the icon, and that's it. They don't even look at the screenshots.
Well, some people read the reviews. Certainly, you know, there are a lot of buyers out there who will read the reviews. But what I've seen from myself and from other developers is, for the most part, we think people read the reviews, but in reality, the reviews don't affect sales that much.
Have you ever had an app that was horribly reviewed, though? Or are you hearing this from other people?
I've had versions of my app that were horribly reviewed. So, like, the overall star rating will still be good, but like this version rating will be not great. It's never a drop below. I think 3.5, but certainly, like, you know, the worst of those have been significant, and then doesn't affect sales at all, at least not noticeably. Well, I told you, like on an iPad 2 launch day, I had no screenshots of my app, and people still bought it.
Yeah.
It's like, I think a lot of app store purchasing is impulse buying. Like, people don't read text on screens that closely. We know that from interface design. If you put up a dialog box with instructions, no one's going to read them. They're going to look at the buttons and hit the one they feel like hitting. And so that's why your buttons have to have descriptive text on them, that they can't just say okay and cancel. They should say like save, don't save, because no one's going to read the text that you put above the buttons. So similar to this, I think people don't really read that closely, or they skim. And so like for me, when I'm buying an app, so first, I if there's a category in which there are paid apps and free apps, I will almost never pick the free apps because I'm suspicious of why they're free. A great example of this is Lose It, an app that I do use for calorie counting when I'm dieting. And it's a great app, but it's free. And I'm really suspicious of it. I'm like, why is this still free? Because it does really well in the App Store. A lot of people use it. A lot of people like it. And I guess they're building up this big database of what people are eating and possibly with the intention of, in the future, suggesting things to you from sponsors of, here, you should try this new Jenny Craig whatever because it's only no calories. And, you know, that to me is a little bit odd. Like, the fact that I can't tell what's paying for this, like, what is funding the development of this app and the continued maintenance of this service that, I, as I said earlier, all software is really a service. What's funding that? And if I didn't pay for it, who is paying for it? Well, that's the same way to state that. And so with a free app, I'm pretty sure that either it's going to be horrible and it's going to be not even worth the time to download and use it, or it's going to be paid for in a way that either I can't see or that I would rather not have. So like ads in an app, I have no tolerance for ads in an iPhone app. Charge me $1 or $2 or whatever it takes for you to remove the ad, and I'll pay that instead. Most people, of course, don't care as much because I'm a geek. As I said, I care more about things than other people. So that's fine. And an app can do well if it's just free and ad-supported, as long as the ad provider is decent and not iAds. But by the way, man, iAds. I really – they couldn't have given it like a worse diss than by not even mentioning it in the keynote.
No,
only 1 year after it was launched. Have we heard – anything from Apple about iAd since, you know, 3 months after its launch?
I mean, what does that say? Does that say that it's a failure? Does it say that they're wanting to downplay it? All of the above?
I think it's definitely a failure. I mean, we're seeing, like, there was that great Bloomberg story that came out this past week about they're cutting the base rates down. All I've heard from Apple about it is, like, maybe 6 months ago, they sent an email to developers saying, hey, now everybody can buy iAds for your apps. You can promote your apps really easily using iAd. And there was some template they would use that, so you wouldn't have to make the whole dynamic thing. You could just like shove in your icon and a banner or something. And I read even from some developers, I didn't try, I never tried it, but I read from some developers who did try it, and they said it was okay, but it ultimately made them very little money, or it lost them money because the cost per click was too high, or the cost per install. So as far as I can tell, iAds is going nowhere. Am I supposed to say iAds or iAd? I think it's
iAds as a, you know, as a platform.
Who knows? Yeah, anyway. And from what I'm hearing from developers is that the fill rate is very, very bad, which means that, you know, you serve an iAd box in your app, and the fill rate is what percentage of the time Apple will put an ad in there. And when they don't have an ad to put in there, I don't know what they run. Do they just leave it blank, or do they have, like with Google AdSense, they'll put in a public service announcement of some sort. And the problem for you as a developer is that if the advertiser doesn't fill that spot for you, you have no way to make money.
Right.
They don't pay you for the public service announcement or for the blank spot. You just get nothing, and they get nothing, and everyone gets nothing. So if you have a poor fill rate, that means that you are effectively losing potential money because the advertiser is not doing their job of selling your ad space and filling it.
Right.
And the impression I get from recent statements from various developers is that the iAd fill rate is something like 20 or 30%. It's really bad. And so usually what happens is there will be some kind of like multi-ad spot thing. Like iAds, I believe, just has a callback so that you can register with some other network. They usually call them remnant networks. The idea being that you have your main advertising network that gives you the high paid, the high price to ads. And then you put in a remnant advertising, which is kind of like, we'll throw whatever we can there. Cheap stuff, not very well targeted, and usually not very high profile.
Garbage.
Or sophisticated advertising. Yeah,
remnants.
Trash ads, yeah.
Garbaggio, as you would say.
That's like when you go on somebody's blog that has AdSense on the side, and the blog is about something useful, and the ads on the side are like, discount Viagra mattresses tomorrow. And you're like, oh, man, that's like, find genocide on eBay today. Oh, like it's rough. That's remnant ads. So what's happening is people who are putting iAds in apps are having to either show nothing in the ad spot a lot of the time, or they have to register with a remnant provider and sell the rest of the inventory as remnant inventory, or run it as that. And so they're seeing their profits go down just by, you know, even if their usage stays the same or goes up, they're seeing their profits per user go down because the rates and the fill rate are both going down. It's really a terrible, it's really a terrible business to be in, the whole ad public. I mean, I hate the ad business. I'm sorry for any of you who are in it. Man, I wonder if we have any listeners who love everything Google does, are Android users, they have a Galaxy Tab, probably even the 7-inch, because we said that was not a very useful size.
All right.
They have a 13-inch MacBook Pro, and they only use free apps and services, and they work in the advertising business, selling remnant ads that we just called trash. And they're probably also Republicans. Do you think we have any listeners that match that kind of criteria? Like, have we angered all of them, and they've all left at this point?
I think if they ever listen to the show, that specific person is gone now.
Probably.
I think it's tough. I mean, it really was interesting to me, the fact, and you mentioned this, that they didn't even bring it up. They did. Nobody mentioned iAds.
Right. It was dead silence on that topic for all of WWDC, as far as I knew. Actually, I think they had a session on it, but that doesn't mean anything. That's like a how-to. But yeah, like that's it. I think that says more than anything. Like when Apple is that quiet about something that isn't clearly doing well, it means it's dead to them. Like,
yeah.
I bet Steve Jobs doesn't give a crap about iAds anymore. It's like it's out of his memory. It's out of his vision. It's just gone. He probably has no involvement with it anymore. Like, I bet if he was ever involved in negotiating deals for it and everything, I bet he's not anymore. I bet it's just totally gone. And like this kind of silo of Apple that is invisible to most of the rest of Apple now. that's my best guess.
Do you think that they will shut it down as a platform, as a service? Do you think it'll be just gone? Or will it continue to exist for those few that want to try to profit off of it or implement it into their apps or whatever? Do you think that it will continue, or at some point will they just sort of have a quiet press release to developers saying this is gone?
That's a good question. You know, there are certainly, you could argue it either way. You know, Apple is a very patient company. So if it seems like something is going to eventually do well, they'll usually keep it alive. In this case, though, it's gotten so much bad press. There's not been any good press about iAds in, well, possibly ever, at least since its launch. And with an ad network, this is not like, you know, it's not like the Core Duo or the Core Solo Mac Mini, you know, where they can have this kind of product that is outdated and is not doing well, but they'll keep it alive because it isn't costing them much. Yeah. In this case, it actually is costing them something. It's costing them a lot of reputation. It's costing them developer relations of some sort, although they don't care that much about that. But you know, it's an embarrassment for them right now. And as the fill rate goes down, which it seems like it's only going down. I don't think I've heard anything good about it. So as the fill rate presumably goes down some more, and as it gets worse to be an iAd publisher, if not, I don't even know how it is for the advertisers. I don't know if there's that low of a fill rate. It probably isn't very good for the advertisers. That probably means they didn't get a lot of repeat business. So it just seems like, and you know, the way Apple operates, it just seems like they'd be a pretty terrible ad company. It's kind of baffling why they got into this business at all. You know, normally they're able to recognize when something is like the hot new trend that they shouldn't get into, and they're cautious and patient enough to not get into it. I think mobile advertising is something that scared them, and that they felt pressure that they had to get into.
Right.
But I think they're finding that they don't really need it.
You know, it's funny though, because everybody criticizes Google, including you earlier in the show, by saying, oh, maybe Google just doesn't get social. Could it be
I'm the first person to ever suggest that.
Yeah, I've never heard it before today. Yeah. But do you think Apple just kind of sucks at creating an advertising platform? Is that it?
Oh, sure. See, the problem is, as an advertising platform vendor, the advertisers are your customers. The consumers are not your customers. They're not eyeballs in ad parlance. I hate that so much. And Apple is, from an advertiser's perspective, they are too controlling and too respectful of their users. Because Apple's customers are the people who buy the apps. Apple's customers in the rest of their business are not the advertisers. Google is different. Google has a few things going for them. One is that they're already a huge force in the ad business. So they can be a bit stubborn and a bit controlling. But also, I think Google is more willing to sell out its users' time and attention, whereas Apple is not. But the whole business of advertising is selling out people's time and attention. That's the whole point. That's what makes the money. That's what gets you advertisers. And so if you aren't willing to do that as much as your competition, or as much as the advertisers want you to, you're not going to do that well. So it's entirely possible that all the advertisers who were looking at iAds possibly went through negotiations a little bit and just decided, you know what, this isn't worth it, or we need more control than that, or we need X feature that you're not going to do because it's going to annoy the crap out of your users. And the entire ad-driven publishing business is always a balance between the users and the advertisers. It's always like, okay, the advertisers, let's say you're selling space on a web page. The advertisers might want to take over the entire background of the page, in addition to having the units in normal spots. Like, that's like the whole page takeover, whatever they call it today. They might even want an interstitial, or even a pop-up or a pop-under, if those still exist. Like, the advertisers will ask you for all these things, and they'll say, well, if you'll do this, I'll give you, I don't know, $10,000. Whatever whatever the price is.
Sure.
And if you go back and say, well, we don't really offer that because you respect your users, you can say, well, you know, we'll offer you this banner up top and the banner on the side and, you know, these defined units, but we're not going to annoy the crap out of our users. Well, then the advertisers either going to say, well, sorry, the deal's off because we want that, or they're going to say, all right, well, then we'll give you maybe $3,000 for that instead, because it's not worth as much to us. And they're right. It isn't worth as much to them, because to them, their whole point is to interrupt you, the user, and get you to look at their stuff and do whatever they want you to do, whether it's buy it or sign up for something or just know their name for the future, for future buying things. Their goals are to distract you in some way. And they'll tell themselves, oh, it's content. Oh, this is content. People love this. No, not really. You know, in some cases, yes. In some cases, ads are helpful. But most of the ad business is putting ads in places where they're not being helpful, where their goal is to distract people and to capture people's attention that wouldn't otherwise have gone there. And so it really is such that the publisher will make more money and will attract more advertisers the more they're willing to sell out their users and to disrespect their time and attention. So Apple is really fundamentally, I don't think, it's not in their DNA to sell out their users like that, to do this well. So they tried doing it in a way that was very respectful of their users. And it turns out most publishers or most advertisers don't really want that. They don't want to buy those ads. And it might not even be a want thing. It might even just be that they can't get that much value out of those ads. Because if the ad is not that annoying and it's easy to get rid of and easy to dismiss and easy right. to ignore, then what value is the advertiser getting out of that? Like, they might not even get enough value to pay for what they paid for the ad. So it might be a loss for them. So maybe that's what happened. Maybe most of the advertisers on iAds actually saw losses from them and decided, you know what, we can't renew this. It's a loss. So I love talking about industries that I have some knowledge of, but
it's easier to speculate when you have less concrete information.
Right. I have just enough knowledge to be able to talk about it and probably really anger the people who know a lot about it. And then they're the ones who email me this week and say, you know, this isn't really how it works and this isn't what happened and you're totally wrong and ads are content and we love ads. There's a service called, I think it's called Ad Keeper. It basically gives people a read later button for ads.
No kidding.
And it came out like a year and a half ago or something. But for some reason, it just got some press like a few weeks ago. And I got a bunch of emails from people saying, what do you think of this? It's like Instapaper for ads. And I'm like, you know, that's fine. But are a lot of people really wanting to save ads for later?
Like, yeah, why would you want to do that?
A common problem? Like, I'm sure some people, again, it's...
Maybe something appeals to you. And you say, you know what, I would like to learn more about that aspirin. And you want to save it. Yeah, you know what, I can almost see that. I mean, I think that's less typical, but sure, why not?
The ad companies probably love it.
I
wrote a blog post like a year ago called The Ad Delusion. And it's like, whoever added those little, on an embedded AdSense ad on a blog, about 2 years ago, they added these little buttons, these little left and right, like greater than, less than symbol buttons so that you can view more ads if you want to. It's like the ad you're seeing there isn't enough.
Right. More.
You want to click on the more button to see the next ad in the screen.
I really like these ads.
Like, what?
These are really great ads.
Who added that? Like, what were they thinking that people, like, I mean, are they just hoping somebody accidentally falls on that link and they get one more little page view out of that or what? Like, what thought process went into designing and releasing that? Like, people actually, somebody in Google is under the impression, unless the intention was just to squeeze out more pennies from accidents, which is possible.
Right.
Like, somebody there, is under the impression that people are dying to see more ads all the time. Oh, yeah, you know, I want to see more. Like, how often do they add something to that box? It's not very often. Like, that's the design of the AdSense embedded box. Right. It's pretty conservative. They add something to it like once every 2 or 3 years. That's, I mean, it's just, wow. So it's the advertiser delusion that ads are content, really.
Right.
So, all right, it's been an hour. I want to now switch over to the laptop follow-up.
Okay, sounds great.
Same deal as last week. If you don't like shows that are longer than an hour, or if you don't want to hear us geeking out about the finer details of the Apple's laptop lineup, please feel free to stop listening now.
Right. Sayonara.
There will be no more discussion about development or Google or advertisers' eyeballs. So by all means, we'll see you later if you don't care. That's fine. All right, so for those who do care, got a lot of feedback. from fans of the 11-inch Air and the 13-inch MacBook Pro. Now, to recap, my overall opinion of these machines is that the 13-inch MacBook Pro, there's very little reason to buy it because it's in the same price ranges as the Airs, and the 13-inch Air, I think, is better than the Pro in many significant ways. Not in every way, of course. You know, the Pro will have bigger hard drives available for it. I believe it might have an 8 gig RAM ceiling, so it probably has a higher RAM ceiling, and it has the optical drive for people who do need that, and it has much faster CPUs available. So those are all great. However, what I don't like about the 13-inch MacBook Pro, the number one problem with it is the screen. It's a 1280 by 800 glass-only screen. Now, that's the same resolution as all the plastic MacBooks have ever been. It's a very, you know, it was an okay resolution when the plastic MacBook came out in 2006. But today, 1280 by 800 is pretty small. Now, right. For reference, the resolution of the 11-inch Air, which I said was a really cramped screen, which I think most people with it would agree. It is a cramped screen. No matter how much you like the 11-inch Air, I think most people with it would agree. Yeah, that's pretty small. The resolution of the 11-inch Air is wider and a little bit shorter. It's 1366 by 768. That's so the 11-inch Air with its small screen actually has about the same number of pixels. I'm adding to the math on that, but it has similar screen area as the 13-inch MacBook Pro.
Right.
The 13-inch MacBook Air has the same resolution as the 15-inch's base screen.
Right, not the high-res one.
Right, the high-res I think is 1680 by something, right?
Right.
But the base model 15-inch, which until about a year ago or maybe a year and a half, whenever they bumped it, I think it was a year and a half ago, this was the only resolution you could get a 15-inch laptop
right.
in.
They came out later with the 1680 by 1050 option.
Yeah, it was the model after I bought mine. They came out with the higher screen.
Yeah.
Which they only do like every 4 or 5 years, so that's significant. So the 13-inch Air has a what I would call a 15-inch class resolution. So it's very, very good in that regard. I'm using one now. The 13-inch Air is an awesome machine. If you need power and whatever else, if you need CPU power, you should look elsewhere, at least until the new ones come out, in which case we'll reevaluate. For screen resolution, it's awesome. It's a really great overall package of you get a lot of screen space in a very thin and light laptop. So, and the glass screen, maybe this is because I care a lot about this and most people don't. That's probably the case, but when I first bought my 15-inch Pro, it was like, actually, I can tell you, it was about 35 days before they added the gloss or the matte option. The 17-inch already had it, but the 15 didn't. And so it was like summer of 09. Yeah. And I got it glossy because I figured that's my only choice now. And I want a 15-inch laptop, so I'll tolerate the glossy, the glass screen. And again, I must reiterate the difference between the kind of glossy they have on the Air and on the old plastic MacBooks is very different from the glass.
Right.
Like I call this plastic glossy. Like the plastic glossy screen is pretty inoffensive. It is a lot less reflective than the glass.
Right.
The bezel is not covered by reflective material, so the bezel is not reflective, which adds a decent amount of area. And it's also very lightweight. The glass, the whole bezel is covered as well, so the reflection of the light over your head will span the bezel area as well as the screen. The glass is far more reflective because it's a much smoother, flatter surface than the plastic glossy, and it's also very heavy. Apple doesn't want to tell you that the laptops are lighter with the anti-glare, but believe me, they are. Go to a store and weigh them, you'll see. It was really tempting to bring my kitchen scale into an Apple store, but so far I've only weighed laptops side by side like in my house from similar generations. But it ends up on the 15-inch, the anti-glare saves something like 0.3 or 0.4 pounds. It's significant. Anyway, so my position is that the 13-inch MacBook Pro would be a great machine if it had the MacBook Air's screen, the 13-inch Air. The exact same screen, 13-inch class. Take it from the Air, put it in the MacBook Pro, and the 13-inch Pro would be a pretty great machine. But it doesn't have that today. And I don't know that it ever will, because Apple wants people to go either up or down the line. Anyway. So that's really the big problem for me is the screen.
Who do you think is the target market for the MacBook Pro 13-inch? Who do you think gets that instead of going up to the 15 or going, I don't want to say down, but going diagonally to the 13-inch Air?
I think the 13 Pro is it's a good machine if you need that amount of CPU power that the Air doesn't offer you in the same general price range, and if you need it to be a lot cheaper than the 15-inch line, because the 15-inch line is certainly more expensive, and it's by a non-trivial amount.
$500
more for roughly equivalent specs.
So for people who really wish they could get the 15 but can't afford it, this is as close as they can get.
Yeah,
they need FireWire.
Yeah, they need all the stuff that But even then, I bet for a lot of those people, they would be happier with an Air if they were both willing and able to give up some of their requirements. Because requirements are that's kind of a squishy word. People don't usually say people often say they need something when in fact they either don't need it or they think they need it or they just want it. And so I got a nice email. Well, you got it too. A guy, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right, Kevin Luzo, I believe, is how I'm pronouncing it. And he wrote a pretty long email basically arguing with me that the 11-inch was a really great machine. And that because what you were looking for, that your key factor was portability. And so because your key factor was portability, then you really should get the 11-inch Air, because that is the most portable machine by a lot. It is significantly smaller than the 13-inch Air.
Yeah, he says, so let's look at Dan's requirements as listed in the podcast by Marco. Primarily use is to be portable, not necessarily going to be doing lots of strenuous work on it. Screen space is not going to be at a massive premium.
Right. So, that the crux of his argument is basically that. It's like that because your key priority was the portability, that you should get an 11-inch. And so my thoughts on that are that there is no such thing as like one key 100% priority in exclusion of everything else. That doesn't exist. Because if your one key priority was portability, just use an iPhone. It's in your pocket all the time. Then that's it, right? By that logic, if you say that because that's his one key priority, then you should get this one computer that's the most portable.
So I'm compromising. I don't have Mac OS X. I have iOS. I don't have a keyboard. I have the on-screen keyboard, and I can fit it in my pocket. It's the ultimate.
Right.
Well, then
It's a very good – the iPhone's a very good machine. You can do a lot with it. Very versatile. Great battery life. By that logic, you can say, or even get an iPad, say, if you don't want to go as extreme. The reality is these factors are – I'm sorry, Merlin. They're priorities. But and there's more than one of them. I know.
27.
But there probably aren't 27 of them. There might be three or four. And so there's always trade-offs. So it's when you're choosing a laptop or a computer model, you're dealing with this series of trade-offs. And very rarely is one of them the most important one, that everything else could be worse and make this one thing better and you would choose that option. So my position in the last show was basically that while the 11-inch Air is very good on portability, you do make a lot of trade-offs with it. It is a much smaller screen, much lower resolution. It has significantly slower CPUs. It has half the disk space available to it. And plus the other general Air trade-offs of there being no FireWire port, no gigabit Ethernet port, a few other little things, crappy video card, but those don't really matter to most people. No optical drive, that matters, but my position is that the 11-inch Air, yes, it does get the portability very well, but you give up a lot. And so looking at your needs, Dan, it seemed like you wouldn't be happy with the 11-inch Air for the same reason that I wouldn't be happy with the 11-inch Air, because we both have relatively high demands of our hardware relative to the average person.
Yeah, sure.
And,
well, it's the ultimate compromise for portability. The people who want an 11-inch Air are the people who are saying, I need a Mac, but make it the absolute smallest Mac, and regardless of what the consequences are of me making that decision, regardless of what I'm giving up, it just has to be small, and that's right. What I need. And it's not just portability, because I'd argue that, and I went back to the Apple Store, which you can actually do here in Austin. You can go to the Apple Store, and there's room to move around, there's room to breathe, you don't get punched. Typically,
as long as you don't melt on the way there,
it's way more comfortable here than it is in Florida, temperature wise. Even when it's 100 degrees here, it's far, far more comfortable than 85 degrees in Florida because of the humidity. The humidity makes this is Florida. You walk out of your house to go from the front door down the walk, down the sidewalk, down the driveway to your car. You will be drenched in sweat. From the time it takes you to get from your front door to your car that's parked outside, you'll be drenched, you'll be uncomfortable, you'll be angry. That's Florida because of the humidity at 85 degrees at 8:30 in the morning. Now here, it's hot, and I'm not gonna, you know, try and pretend that it's not hot, but typically the humidity is not here. It is way, way, way more tolerable. I can be outside and it'll be 95, 100 degrees. And I'm way more comfortable than I was in Florida. People are like, oh, you're going to get used to that temperature. It's going to be pretty hot. Yeah. You know what? The humidity is the issue. It's never the heat. It's humidity. The humidity is what makes
totally
it.
Totally agreed.
So going in there, I went and I looked and I said, all right, here's the 13, here's the 11. I can totally see what you're talking about being on the airplane. Where the 11-inch, you can put that on the seat. You're not going to have a problem, even when the person in front of you is ignorant and rude enough to recline fully. Now, if the person has a medical problem, I grandfather them in. If they have a problem, you know, bad back or something legitimate that's been diagnosed.
You know, it's actually much better for your back to not recline the seat.
I believe it. But in any case, if they have some medical need that necessitates that that's okay. So that's, but you know, I'm not in that situation really ever or at all very frequently. So, you know, if that's like the benefit, that's the main, or I'll have more space on the coffee table at the, you know, in the restaurant or whatever, you know, those things are things that the trade-off for me, again, you know, the screen, the additional battery life, things like that. The 13-inch still winds up being more appealing. The people that I went back and asked again, and I'll mention Jason Snell again. I know his title is always a little bit different, but he's essentially like the editor in chief of Macworld. When I asked him about laptops, he's like, "Well, I have a very specific requirement." He's like, "I just want my laptop to be absolutely as small as possible." That's his goal when he gets a laptop. He just wants it to be as small as possible. I think using the word portable is a little bit more difficult because I'd argue that the 13-inch is just as portable as the 11. They're both in the same class of portability.
I mean, I said last time the 15-inch is really pretty portable. Like we're nitpicking over like 1 pound differences here. The 15-inch overall, compare, like, look around at the non Apple world and see what people are carrying. Like, the 15-inch is very portable.
They're all really portable, and so going from the 11 to the 13, yeah, the 11 will fit in a smaller. You'll need less space. It'll fit into a smaller area than the 13. But I feel like the compromises that you make are too great. I'm sticking with the 13. And I'm hoping Apple comes out. Where is it? Where is the 13? Where is the new one? If it comes, especially if it has a backlit keyboard, it's a no-brainer.
I will say I do miss that. I miss the backlit keyboard with mine.
That's the worst without that. Because I have a 13-inch MacBook. Not a Pro, it's just the first generation of 13-inch. It's a 13-inch aluminum MacBook. It has no FireWire. It's
the weird one.
The worst laptop Apple has made in recent memory. And then I've got the 15-inch, and just not having that back. Like I can't imagine. It's one of those things that you try to imagine. Like how can you not have one of those? And I used to have a machine that didn't have one, and I have this one now that I just, that's the worst. That's the worst. You got to have that. You got to have that.
Yeah.
So I'm just waiting. If the minute that they announce these 13s, the new MacBook Airs, I'm getting one. Now, what do you do? What do you do if you have? Because a buddy of mine said, Dan, I'll sell you this 11-inch Air I've got. How much will you give me for it? I'm like, at this point, it's worthless to me.
Right.
I have no interest in it. You know, and he'd probably give me a really, really good deal on it. I'm like, what do I want that for? I don't. Not because it's an 11-inch, but because they're about to be supplanted by something that's going to be significantly better and more forward-looking. With Sandy Bridge is one thing, just Thunderbolt is another. I mean, who knows that in a year from now, what kind of really awesome Thunderbolt drives or, you know, external devices we're going to have. It's going to be great. It's going to be a whole new world with the Thunderbolt.
You know, I really hope that takes off. I mean, that can really... You know, because as we've said in the past, Thunderbolt is basically PCI Express over a cable. And so what you attach to it effectively runs at full speed, we think. You know, it's hard to say without being able to have these devices and play with them and not having very many benchmarks available. But yeah, as far as we know, it is basically PCI Express over a cable. So if you could have, say, a Thunderbolt to FireWire adapter, and if it works the way we think it does, that would be just as good as having an internal FireWire port.
Right.
It would be at full speed. Same thing with gigabit. That's why, like, a while ago I wrote speculation about, like, you know, when might the 15-inch line adopt the Air's wedge shape and get thin and drop the optical drive? Like, might this be sometime soon? And the problem I had was to do that, to adopt the wedge shape and still maintain anywhere near reasonable proportions, there would be nowhere in the laptop thick enough to put a gigabit Ethernet port or a FireWire 800 port. But if they put a Thunderbolt port in it, especially if they put a couple of them in, then you can just sell adapters for those things. So for the relatively few people who buy 15-inch laptops who need FireWire and gigabit, they could now have that via Thunderbolt with an adapter, if such an adapter would ever actually come out on the market. And we don't know what they're going to cost. I heard speculation that they might be like $100 for one of those adapters, which might not be that unreasonable for that kind of benefit.
Especially if they deliver on the promise of not needing any drivers, not needing anything else. It's just a simple, here's the cable, done.
Right, exactly. If it really is that easy, that's going to be great. And it's not going to replace USB because it's just much more complex and much more costly to implement in devices and apparently cables. It's going to be, I think it's going to replace FireWire at least in the long term. Maybe not this year. Maybe next year though. Who knows?
FireWire has been around way longer than anybody thought it would once USB 2 and some of these other protocols started coming out. But it's hanging on.
Oh, yeah. Because USB is terrible. I haven't tried USB 3 yet, but USB 1 and 2 are both, well.
Apple seems to have turned a blind eye to USB 3.
Yeah.
They're moving on to Thunderbolt. They've made their decision.
And that variable might be for their relationship with Intel. Like, I bet that helped that relationship.
I'm sure.
Somehow.
That's a good point.
But anyway, and what about the Mac Pros? This was probably worth a few seconds of discussion. Because honestly, Mac Pro updates, even though I use a Mac Pro and I love the Mac Pro, unless I'm waiting to buy one, I don't really care what they're updating because it's not that interesting to most people because most people aren't buying them. The rumor came out with these new part numbers that, these are the new Airs and these are new Mac Pros. And I've always said that, you know, you look at Intel's roadmap for the Xeon CPUs because they all use Xeons. Look at the Xeon roadmap. You can look at it on Wikipedia. And it tells you approximate release dates for all the new CPUs that are coming up pretty soon. And you can see, okay, the Mac Pro to date has always had one or two CPU sockets. And they're both Xeons. And the only Xeon that can do dual sockets of the new family hasn't come out yet. It's the Sandy Bridge Xeons are the E3, the E5, and the E7. I think there's an E7. I don't know about that. But the E3 is already out. I have a server with it. It's actually really good. It's very, very good. very fast. Similar to what we've seen in the desktop and laptop world, the Sandy Bridge CPUs are really great. So certainly when they come to servers, we can see that too, and we are seeing that with the E3. E3 is single socket only. So if Apple released a Mac Pro with CPUs that are available today, assuming they wouldn't want to use any of the old ones, which I think is a safe assumption, they wouldn't issue an update if they were using old CPUs, unless it was the MacBook Air. They wouldn't do a Mac Pro update with old CPUs. So if they issued an update today with the parts that we know are available today, there wouldn't be a dual socket model. Now, that might be the reality. There might actually be no dual socket Mac Pro in the next version. We don't know. I suspect that's unlikely. I think what's much more likely is that Apple will make new Mac Pros available as soon as Intel can get them those dual socket chips, the Xeon E5 line, which officially the release date is this fall sometime. I think Q4 was the official date. Apple does occasionally get a bit of a lead on Intel CPUs, but it's not much. It's usually not more than a few weeks. So it's possible new Mac Pros could come out tomorrow, or if they already came out today during this podcast, or next week. And, you know, similar to the MacBook Air, they've been predicted just about every 2 weeks for the last few months. And so eventually the people saying, oh, they're coming out next week, eventually they're going to be right. And then we're going to forget all the times they messed up. And next time they predict, we're going to think, oh, they're credible. But I think, yeah, the next Mac Pro is probably going to be very similar to the current one. People are saying, oh, it might have a rack mount enclosure, or it might be smaller and just use Thunderbolt for a lot of things. I think the rack enclosure is possible in that they might sell some kind of tray that could hold it sideways somewhat securely and that would rack mount for a few $100. Who knows? Something like that. I don't think the case itself is going to rack mount with no additional hardware. I don't know. I think that would make it very ugly and weird, and I don't see that happening. So that's plausible. Thunderbolt being added to them is a given, but the idea of eliminating a lot of internal expansion slots or ports in favor of Thunderbolt, I think is unlikely. I think even a significant case redesign is unlikely, because the current case is doing them pretty well. It holds a giant motherboard they need for the server chips. It holds lots of RAM. It holds lots of drives. It holds a few slots. And optical drives, you know, who cares? They'll keep those bays around, I think. But, you know, who cares? I don't anticipate Blu-ray being a part of it. And I think it's going to be just like every other Mac Pro update, where it's going to be interesting to very high-end buyers, pretty much meaningless to everyone else, and not a huge departure from the previous Mac Pro. It's going to be more expensive than anyone wants it to be, and people are going to complain, and PC people are going to compare it to the consumer CPUs that they use, and they're going to say, oh, I can't believe Apple's charging $4,000 for their entry-level computer, even though, you know, they're comparing it to their, like, you know, Core i7 instead of using the Xeons that Apple's using, and they're not using a server motherboard, and they're not using a big power supply, and not having all this stuff that Apple puts in their computers. So all that stuff's going to happen, and it's going to happen either next week or a month from now or 3 months from now or 6 months from now. Doesn't really matter. I'm glad I talked about it for 15 minutes.
Then we should probably wrap, though.
Yeah, I think that's good.
So if they do come out with new hardware, I'm still going to be getting the 13.
Yeah, really think, you know, assuming if everything that we're guessing ends up being true, which is that a new 13-inch Air comes out in a day or a week or 2 weeks that has Sandy Bridge CPUs at good clock speeds and Thunderbolt port, that's going to be a hell of a machine.
Yeah.
And I think if it were me and I was buying my next like sole only computer, I think I would still go 15. But as a portable computer or for people with less demanding needs, I think it's going to be awesome. But we'll see. We'll see what happens.
We'll see. So that's about it for this week. You can follow Marco on Twitter at Marco Arment. I'm Dan Benjamin on Twitter. You can go to 5x5.tv to hear back episodes of this show, as well as all of the other shows that we do here at 5x5, which we really hope you enjoy. You can rate the show on iTunes. Remember, it's either a 5-star or a don't rate it at all. I'm just kidding. We'd love to hear what you think. And that really helps new listeners find out about the show. very much appreciate the sponsorships today from FreshBooks.com and Shopify.com. Go get a free cake and use a coupon 5x5, respectively. And thanks very much for tuning in. We will be back here again next week.